Okay, well, I'll go ahead and get started now. Because those of you who've been on tours of exhibits with me in the past know full well that I can go on endlessly. I will try not to with this one, but there's a lot of stuff in this exhibit. The exhibit is from the Berg, being of course Williamsburg, from the Berg to Berlin and beyond, World War II at Zwem Library. And so almost everything in the exhibit is from the collections of Zwem Library. There are a few items that people lent us, like some of the medals, some ration books, and so on. But pretty much everything else is from our collections, mostly from special collections, but some stuff from the main stacks. Okay. And I'll just briefly tell you what the overall exhibit is, and then talk about items in the individual cases. We start here with the background to the war and the early war before the U.S. got involved, both in Europe and the Pacific, and then the news of Pearl Harbor. In that case, we focus on William and Mary going to war and what happened at the college. Over there is the home front, focusing on Williamsburg, but some of the stuff is broader than simply Williamsburg. Over here on my right, the last of the rotunda cases focuses on the soldiers and the military experience in the war. And then inside of Special Collections, the upright case has the end of the war and its aftermath. And then the three flat cases focus on particular civil liberties issues and events, as well as the Holocaust, which is in a sense a civil rights and civil liberties issue, but it seems sort of bigger than that. And so we'll start here with the first case. And we do have on this side material relating to Europe and the background to the war in Europe and to U.S. participation in the war. And so we do have some materials from when Germany invaded France. We have the papers of a man named Albert Raymond. He was a businessman in Paris, an American businessman in Paris, at the time war broke out, been living there since the 1920s. And he volunteered to serve in the American ambulance volunteers. They were helping the French at the time of the invasion. He was actually captured by the Germans. His ambulance was stopped by the Germans, and he was imprisoned. And we have various letters from his family, from his daughter, frantically trying to find out where her father was, what had happened to him, and then trying to secure his release. And you really feel for the daughter because her mother also was missing during this time. And she was pregnant. I mean, she was old. She was married. I mean, she was an adult. But the letters get increasingly frantic, and they all were eventually reunited. The father was released with help from American diplomats and the company that employed him and so on. So we've got some of the papers relating to that, photos of him with his ambulance and so on. We also have some books from the main stacks that show some of the events in Europe. And so this is about France. And it actually is a book that was published in France when the Allies had retaken France. But it documented the German occupation. And the Illustrated London News is open to some of the bomb damage in London, specifically in this case, the altar of St. Paul's Cathedral, designed by Sir Christopher Wren. So it's obvious why we picked that particular one. Okay, but up here, we have some photos of, was at the time, Captain John Leslie Hall, Jr., who is an alumnus of the college, was the highest ranking person from William and Mary in the military during World War II. Here, before the U.S. got officially involved in the war, He was very important in some of the ways the U.S. was helping Britain. And so we had the destroyer for bases deal, we had Lend-Lease and so on. And one of the other things was the U.S. Navy began escorting American ships supplying Britain farther and farther across the Atlantic. And so he helped build some of the bases in Iceland. And these are photos from Iceland and the U.S. involvement there. Okay. Over on this side, we move into the Asian side of the war. Okay. And we do have the papers of several people who were in China, of Americans in China, before the war, before Pearl Harbor, when Japan had invaded China. And in this case, these are the papers of Carl Neprud, who was an American who was a customs officer, actually the highest ranking customs officer in China at the time. And this is a scrapbook he kept of photos, things, and the map up there, Shanghai is also his, as is this book, Shanghai Under Fire. Okay. And then, of course, we've got stuff relating to the attack on Pearl Harbor, a reproduction of the newspaper. We actually don't have any copies of the newspapers, original copies. And all of our magazines, like Time and Newsweek, that would have had stuff, either didn't publish anything or, in a couple of cases, those issues have been torn out. So we do have a repro. This was a very interesting item. This is actually, I am judging from the English language translation that was with it. I don't read Japanese, so I don't know. But it is apparently Japan's declaration of war on the U.S. And there is, the translation is right up there, the first page of the translation. And it's interesting because, of course, first it talks about China and Japan's invasion of China and how China really forced Japan to do that, just as Britain and the U.S. forced Japan to attack them. And so it's very self-serving in that regard. And then up here we have Pearl Harbor at William and Mary. And this is from the Alumni Society's Wartime Memory Project. And so they did ask alumni to write in with their memories of the war. And these are some of the ones who remembered hearing about Pearl Harbor here at the college after lunch on that Sunday, December 7th. And you know, someone running down the hallway shouting, and one guy saying, Pearl Harbor, he had no idea where it was. He said his public school geographies course clearly did not prepare him for this. And they talk about all the shock and sitting in Trinkle Hall the next day, which is where the cafeteria was, listening to President Roosevelt's speech asking Congress to declare war. And then the national anthem was played, and that a lot of the girls were crying. The boys were very, very serious looking because obviously many of them would be going to war. And so that's what's in this case. And so we move on here from Pearl Harbor to William and Mary actually responding to the war. Okay. And it was a challenge, and for those of you who came to my talk at homecoming, you've heard me mention that when I first started researching this, I was appalled. I was afraid I was going to have to get up here and say William and Mary was the only unpatriotic college in the country. Because if you look at the flat hat, which was the first thing I did, if you look at the flat hat, it doesn't really mention Pearl Harbor. The first issue after December 7th, nowhere does it say Japan's attacked, we're at war now. The big issue has to deal with the AAUP. And the college being censored for something. And, but there's little mentions in it that make you realize, yes, they knew war had been attacked. It didn't go to press before Pearl Harbor, because it says, well, it would be a pity to, there's an editorial that says, it would be a pity to chop down the cherry trees in Washington just because we're at war with Japan, you know, and things like that. So you know we're at war. Several days later, the Flat Hat published a letter from the college president, President Bryan, where he's telling the male students, well, yeah, okay, if you want to go off and enlist, or you're going to go work in war industry, fine, we applaud you, you go with our blessing and all of that. But for those of you who want to stay here and study, you too are contributing just as much to the war effort. So it's this very kind of bizarre Flat Hat experience. But then as I looked more at the Wartime Memory Project, and it talked about a lot of the guys going off immediately and enlisting and so on, and as I read the president's papers and so on, I realized what the president really was freaked out about was that with all the males going away, would the college survive? And that was actually a very real question. And so President Bryan and his successor, President Pomfret, both tried desperately to get some of the war training programs for the college as a way of propping up the college's finances. And they did succeed. They got the Naval Chaplain School, and you'll see here various photos of the Naval Chaplains, Navy troops in the Wren Yard, the chaplains in, appropriately enough, the chapel, and so on, marching by the sunken garden, and so on. And there was a massive lobbying campaign by the college and its alumni and trustees and so on to get these. But there's this absolutely hilarious diary by a woman named Margaretta Hirsch. And she was a student at the college during much of the war, wrote faithfully in her diary every day, contributed to the war effort. She was one of the observers in the top of the church tower. They were airplane observers, so we've got her armband back there. And there were various ways people could participate to help out the war effort, and they're listed up here in this war program. But when they make the announcement about the Naval Chaplain School, this is what she wrote in her diary. She said, "Also, it was announced that W&M is being used to train naval," and then in capital letters, "chaplains!" exclamation point. "Isn't it hell? No ensigns!" And then in parentheses, "Air Corps. She wanted pilots." Okay. It's like, okay, not these naval chaplains that are going to be married men and, boring and so on. Okay. Fortunately, if you go farther into the diary, so that's February 1943. In October 1943, you see, "Drooped around all afternoon till time to make ourselves smooth and go to the chaplain's reception and dance. Golly gee, I surely do love naval chaplains. They were all young, unmarried, and completely smooth. I sort of got warmed by and think that by the end of the evening, 8 to 10, I knew practically every chaplain there, and I danced with everything from a Catholic priest to a Jewish rabbi. Though I hadn't known any of them before, I had a sensational time, one of the best ever." Okay. And this was a girl who went on a lot of dates during the war. And she documents all of them. For the women who were here, great time, even though after freshman year there were virtually no male full-time students. Great time for the women between the chaplains, the Army training program, which was kind of accelerated training in some courses for people going into the military, for guys training as Army officers, basically, for languages, math, and so on. They'd get accelerated training and military training. It was a pretty rigorous program. And some of those students who were here as part of that Army training did come back afterwards and get degrees from William and Mary. And so you also see some photos here of the Army training units. So we have that. The college also made some other adjustments for the war effort. Okay. They did offer additional courses for the students who were here full-time. such as camouflage, making camouflage. And so we've got these two photo sets of photos here of the camouflage course and some of the camouflage items that they came up with. And this was to be camouflage from the air. And so you can see them down by Lake Metoka building some of the camouflage units. Okay. The college also was honored by various victory ships. So there was an SS James Blair, for example, and there was an SS William and Mary victory ship, which were the ones that carried supplies. And this was christened in Baltimore in early 1945. This is actually the champagne bottle that was used for that christening, and a photo of Eleanor Harvey, who was the head of the student women's government, christening the ship. And she gave us the champagne bottle last year. So that's been a happy addition to our collection. Okay. Other changes included summer school for the first time to try to help the guys who were here to get through faster, for example. And there also was a lot of trouble with the male faculty because they were also going off. So there was a struggle to keep the college staffed as well. Okay. The sad part of the war, of course, were the people who were lost in the war. The Alumni Gazette did a really good job. Every issue would have updates on William and Mary folks in the military, promotions, who was known to be where, who was in what service, reports on the injured, the missing, and sometimes the killed. At the end of the war, in March 1946, the Alumni Gazette did publish a list of the 81 alumni reported to be killed in the war. So they wanted to make sure it was right before they did a plaque. And the college also tried to keep track. The president, whenever he heard of anyone being killed, would write to the family, and that was one of the really sad duties. In this case, the father of an alumnus named Robert Donnelly, Lieutenant J.G. Donnelly, was killed in a carrier plane. He was a fighter pilot for a carrier in the Pacific, was killed. He wrote, actually, Dean Lambert. Apparently, Lieutenant Donnelly had worked a lot with Dean Lambert. And so he wrote Dean Lambert to tell him about Donnelly's death and sent along the little memorial card you see here. And then President Pomfret wrote to him. And that's the letter of condolence over here. Okay, so we'll move on to the home front, but you've already got a sense of some of that. Some of the changes. World War II was a massive mobilization. 15 million Americans ended up in the military during the course of the war, which, you know, even today would be a huge chunk of the population, but the population was substantially smaller then, so 15 million was a lot. Millions more people moved to work in war industry, and so there was this real population shift. Hampton Roads as a whole, including Williamsburg, grew enormously during the war. Okay. In Williamsburg itself, there was Camp Perry. Okay. But there was also nearby, of course, the Yorktown Naval Depot, and then in Hampton Roads, all sorts of other military bases. And so the town was just hopping with military personnel and their families. Colonial Williamsburg, which was known as the Williamsburg Restoration then, did actually close the lodge and the inn to outside visitors. It was just military personnel were staying there for part of the war. They still had dances and stuff, and our friend Margetta does note going to dances and things at the lodge and eating at the lodge and so on. There were many different ways people on the home front could contribute to the war effort, and so there were savings bonds drives, and you can see a photo there of savings bonds drives. They could work at the USO clubs, and there was a USO club in Williamsburg. It was actually in one of the former frat buildings. The college took the opportunity the war presented to crack down on the frats, since there weren't as many male students anyway. They took away the residences, and that's when some of the lodges were built near the student center. Okay. There were all sorts of fundraising efforts. There was collecting tins and, you know, other scrap metal and so on. There was gardening, and those were some of the activities people both in town and students from the college engaged in. There was also, of course, rationing of food and of clothing. Margetta Hirsch notes in her diary that they were limited to 3 pairs of shoes a year, which she said was a real problem on the bricks of Williamsburg. She said the bricks really wear the shoes down fast, and so it was a challenge in Williamsburg. Okay. We have some ration books here and some ration stamps. There was also lots of advice about how to deal with the rationing. And so we do have this issue of Bread and Butter. It was published every week by a consumers group and talked about what was in short supply and what wasn't, and would suggest substitutions to make and so on. This issue of The Joy of Cooking, which was lent to us by Chandi, dates from the war years, and it's got recipes for sugarless cakes and other items to adapt to the shortages. Okay. And by the way, right here against the sidewall, there's actually something about feeding your dog in wartime. And so we have an article on that. Okay. There were also some brighter sides with the home front. And so the music from World War II was very patriotic and often quite cheerful. And so you'll see G.I. Jive, and there's a Star-Spangled Banner waving somewhere, and this is the Army, and so on. Many of the military bases did have their own publications and so on, and we do have some issues of Camp Perry's newspaper. Camp Perry was home to the Seabees, and so it was called the Beeline, and you can see there was a song contest, and they usually had football teams and so on, and some of those games were played at Carey Field. Okay. This is, by the way, another Camp Perry item. This is actually a military item, but it was Camp Perry, so we put it in this case. And this is a buddy book, and it actually does say buddy book on the front cover, kept by a CB who was stationed for a while at Camp Perry. And so it was where his friends could record their names and addresses and civilian and military and so on and make some comments. And so it's open to one of the pages with his Camp Perry friends. And this is his unit at Camp Perry. Okay. And then you'll see down here photographs of the Navy Day Parade in Williamsburg in 1943. There were a lot of parades. Sometimes the naval chaplains and the Army Specialized Training Unit at the college participated and so on. And you can see a float over on the left side here with very big ears on it and little kids watching it going down Dog Street. Okay. The last thing I want to point out in this case are these letters from Mary Haldane Coleman to her friend Julia Wilson. A very close correspondence in the war. Mary Haldane Coleman, who's responsible for us getting the Tucker Coleman collection, by the way. She's the Coleman side of that. She's a Tucker descendant. Lived in the Tucker House, which is now part of Colonial Williamsburg. And we've got these wonderful letters she wrote every day. And in the one on the right here, she's complaining about how crowded it was in Williamsburg during the war. And she talks about how people would come up every day, because there was this massive housing shortage, people would come up every day to the house, knock on the door, and demand to be allowed to stay there. And she always refused, and she said she took to being aggressive and would just head them off at the pass and talk about how Williamsburg had just been overwhelmed by the people coming, and the locals couldn't go to the hospital, they didn't bother going to the movies, the stores were too crowded for them to go to, and you know, on and on about how awful it was for them. And she said it took people aback. Yes, I imagine it did. And then here on in the letter on the left, she talks about something that happened in 1945, early 1945 in Williamsburg. And that is, in addition to being home to the Seabees, Camp Perry also was home to a prisoner of war camp. And some of the prisoners, German prisoners, escaped. And so she talks about their escape and how they were captured in someone's backyard and so on. She said they had American uniforms on, but they were unfinished uniforms, because that was one of the things that they worked in, was making uniforms. Okay, so we'll move on now to the soldier's experience, other than the buddy book, and the military experience. Okay. And we do have a variety of items here. Some of them are related to William and Mary Peeple, and some aren't. We started collecting a lot of World War II material, and we hope to collect more of it. I am going to talk to the Alumni Society about that. But so we do have first here some letters from a nurse named Lina Potter. And this is a collection we bought last year. And that's Lina up there. She's a little bit older when the war started. And she was sent to China, India, and Burma as a nurse. And in this letter talks about the fact that it's mostly Chinese, actually. She's in India, but it's mostly Chinese officers that are in that are coming to the hospital where she worked. And she also talks a little bit about, in many of her letters, she talks about the social classes and talks about the natives that they're dealing with. She also has this fascinating, in some of the letters, this fascinating struggle to get to particularly the place in Burma where the hospital was, and the days and days of travel to get there. Okay. And then down here we have the scrapbook and some other items from Colonel Amos Kuntz. He was a William and Mary alumnus, had served as a doctor in World War I. He was had gone to Hopkins Medical School, was a doctor at Hopkins Hospital. And so he'd served in World War I. When World War II came along, he was called up again and commanded a hospital in the Pacific. And so he's got all these scrapbooks showing the hospital, lots of photos of the hospital and other things. We've got a service record there. And also of interest, remember I said a lot of the bases published newsletters and other things. So these are publications from his hospital. And it's actually the Coconuts is their newsletter. And it is the Christmas version, home edition. Okay, and then the Christmas menu for the hospital in the Pacific. Okay. On this side, we have several things. This is our only edition of Stars and Stripes. It's Stars and Stripes Mediterranean. We just have the one issue. Okay. In the upper right is a newspaper. If you've seen the movie A Bridge Too Far, this dates from that Operation Market Garden. And it actually was a souvenir newspaper published by Dutch people there for the American paratroopers. So that's what's up there. I want to point out most of the posters that you see around are American posters from the war, and largely reproductions from originals in our collection. We didn't want the originals to be subject to that much light. But this actually is a British poster urging civilians to be very careful with what they said, that people are always overhearing. But don't miss the Hitler faces on the wall. Okay? The wall decoration actually is a kind of abstract Hitler. Okay? Here we have some materials relating to Professor Galfo. Some of you know, may know Professor Galfo, retired education professor. He has given us his collection. He was a pilot during the war, bomber pilot in Europe. He hadn't come to William and Mary yet. He was a young man, obviously, at the time. And this silk map folded up here was a map given to the pilots. And he's marked on it all the places he bombed. And so that's what we have, the reproduction. The material is pinned on the reproduction, obviously, not on the original. And these are V-mails he sent, of letters he sent to his mother in Buffalo during the war, and a log of his flights and so on. This short guide to Great Britain actually is from a different collection of someone who was sent to Britain during the war. And I wish we had space for it, because it's just a hoot. You know, it's telling people how to talk with the British, and don't insult them, and yes, their clothes are shoddy, but, you know, they've been at war longer than we have, and yes, they keep things cold, and no, they're not going to be really excited to hear how the Americans have come to save them again. So, you know, be sensitive about that. And down here we have some D-Day related materials. First we have letters from this nurse, Mary Switzer. That's Mary in back, and photos of some of the things she saw. She landed a few days after D-Day in Normandy. And this is a letter to her parents where she talks about her first night in a foxhole. Okay. And in some of the other letters from her collection, she's, you know, typically an insensitive young person to their parents' concerns, although she's trying to be sensitive. And so there's this one letter where she writes about all the dangers they were in and so on, and she says, you know, quite cheerfully, "But don't worry, I've been a lot closer to the front than this." Okay, darling, that's very reassuring. And then our old friend John Leslie Hall was by now an admiral. He was really kind of the king of amphibious operations. And so he was very much involved in all of the amphibious operations, first in the Mediterranean and then with Normandy. So he was in charge of the planning and actually a lot of the execution of getting the troops over there, getting them onto the landing areas and so on. And so these are some of the telegrams sent to him a couple of weeks after D-Day. So his job was done. He was leaving the area. A lot of the other officers that he'd worked with then emailed him congratulations and so on and best wishes as he was departing the landing area. Okay, so now we'll move into special collections. And we'll be wrapping up the war here. Okay, and so here in the upright case, we have the end of the war. First, the announcement of Franklin Roosevelt's death in April of 1945, just a few weeks before Germany surrendered. We do have, and I don't know how we got them, but we do have a series of photographs of his funeral, some of them quite up close, like this one right here. You can see the flag right there. That's his casket being moved into the Capitol to lie in state, and of Harry Truman being sworn in as president. Okay. And this letter up here is from a guy named Herman Recht. He was a CB stationed at Camp Perry for much of the war and wrote every day to his wife back in New Jersey. And this is about hearing that Franklin Roosevelt was dead and the shock it was to all of them. President Truman, of course, discovered a couple of days after he became president that there was a secret weapon being developed that was, of course, the atomic bomb. And we do have here a couple of photos of damage at Hiroshima. They were taken by Eugenia Robb. If you know our volunteer, Frances Robb, Eugenia is one of her cousins. Okay. And Eugenia was a very young Red Cross worker. She was just 18, was sent to the Philippines and then Japan. And so she did take, after the war, and so she did take photos of the damage. She also spent one day at the trial of Tojo. And so that's actually this photo here. And you can see Tojo in the center of that. And we have letters where she writes about being at the trial. Okay. One of the people who worked for the prosecution in the Japanese war crime trials was Otto Lowe, who's William and Mary class of 1923. And so he sent a huge amount of the materials relating to the prosecution to William and Mary. And so this is the prosecutor's opening statement in the Japanese war crime trials. So that's obviously, you can only see the front page of it. Okay. Okay. Over here we move to Europe and the aftermath of the war in Europe. Eugenia Robb was transferred to Germany. And so we have some photos of her with a friend in Germany and some of the ruins in Germany. We also have a collection we bought a year ago by a woman named Betty Movern, who was a Virginia resident, went over to Germany to be with her army officer husband, who was part of the occupation. And so she writes about Frankfurt and the damage in Frankfurt, and that's what these two pages are. And then you can see some of the photos of the damage in Frankfurt. Okay. We also have the papers of a guy named James Critchfield. He was an Army intelligence officer and was very much involved in denazification because, of course, although we'd been allies with the Soviet Union during the war, even before war's end, the Soviet Union and Britain and the U.S. together started jockeying in a kind of communist versus free world, what became the Cold War. And so how to deal with Germany was one of the issues. Okay? And how do you strengthen Germany against Russia? Obviously, Germany was divided. And so he's very involved in denazification. Okay? And so this Camp 71 that you see the book here, and this is a second copy of the book, was a camp where many German officers and others were sent, and so civic officials and so on, were sent to be kind of vetted as to whether they should be allowed to go free. They didn't want to totally take away all the leadership because they needed to stand against the Soviet Union. They needed a strong West Germany. And so that's what these are about. And you can see also the German denazification law, some of the guidelines and so on. There's a lot of really interesting stuff in the Critchfield papers. He later retired to Williamsburg, and that's how we ended up with his papers. Okay. The last three cases are the ones that deal with more civil liberties issues. And in this case, we have two sets of them relating to U.S. civil liberties. One on this side is a series of papers relating to a anti-fifth column group in Montclair, New Jersey. We bought this collection this past year, and it was called the Intelligence Division of the Montclair Security Council. It wasn't a formal government operation, and it was set up before Pearl Harbor. They actually became active in 1940. And recruited people to report on others who were showing pro-Japanese or pro-German sympathies. And so it's very much keeping with this poster from the FBI, you know, saying, if you suspect the presence of enemy agents, tell it to the FBI. Well, that's what this group did. And so you have some of the reports. And some of it is so-and-so is supposedly the nephew of, you know, Goering, or other things like that. So-and-so had a photo of himself with Hitler, or, you know, made sympathetic comments about Germany, or so on, and should be investigated. And so it's really kind of creepy. Okay. And over on this side is a little bit of stuff dealing with the Japanese American internment camps. We do have a bunch of news releases from the War Department right after Pearl Harbor for like the first 6 months. And this was someone who then went into the military, and we have his collection. He was a newspaper reporter. And so he had all these releases. And this is one from Hawaii later in December 1941, so just a couple weeks after Pearl Harbor. And it talks about how the vast majority of the Japanese population is loyal to the United States, and that there's not really any trouble with subversive behavior or anything like that. So it just is a contrast to them being put in these internment camps. We also have a clipping from the Flat Hat where later in the war, a woman whose family was in an internment camp came to the college and spoke. Okay. One of the faculty members who was hired on a temporary basis during the war did get in trouble. He was a conscientious objector, and he got in trouble for being sympathetic to the Japanese Americans. Okay. Over in this case, this is all about the Holocaust. We do have some original Holocaust photos here of the camps at Dachau. And these are reproductions that were also included in that collection. And so there are some very disturbing photos here. We also have this facsimile of the book includes Hitler's political last will and his personal last will and testament. And so we've included his political last will and where he goes on about how the Jews were to blame for so much, and you know that history should judge him kindly because it was all the Jews' fault. And so that's there. Then we do have two letters in our collection that mention the extermination of people in Poland. The first is from a Polish refugee who was a countess and is normally, by the way, utterly insensitive, but she was very literate in English. And she does here at the bottom of the letter talk about the concentration camps in Poland. The other is Hermann Recht, the CB who wrote daily to his wife from Camp Perry. He was Jewish, and at the beginning of this letter, he talks about reading a book about some of what was going on. This was early in 1945, and how sick it made him. So there's that. And then we wrap up with William and Mary again. And this is the Flat Hat Incident of 1945. The editor of the Flat Hat, Marilyn Camerley, who is a northerner, in early 1945, wrote an editorial called Lincoln's Job Half Done. And in it, she called for eventual integration of African Americans at William and Mary, called for allowing African Americans and whites to intermarry, which was banned in Virginia and many other states, and so on. And she didn't push for it to be immediate, okay, but eventual. But nonetheless, it caused this huge controversy. The Board of Visitors wanted to kick her out of the college. President Pomfret did take a stand and insisted she be allowed to graduate. So she was fired as editor of the Flat Hat, but was allowed to graduate. The Board of Visitors apologized to her in 1987. But it became this national controversy, and there were all these people writing in to the college, and there were newspaper stories about it all over. And so you can see some of that material here. There also is this article about the firing much later and so on. But you can see some of the telegrams and some of the very nasty racist things people wrote against her. So...